Fortnite in Film is a podcast where every week you get the chance to listen in on a group of film lovers chatting about the great, or not so great, movies that we've been watching over the past fortnight. Hello and welcome to episode 37 of A Fortnight in Film. I'm your host Jason, thanks for tuning in. Our first episode of 2023 after a very long layoff of a few months in between episodes. And in that time, we have gained a new co-host. So Christian is stepping back from the podcast. We'll use the terminology that the royal family use. You know, he's stepping back because there's not any, you know, we didn't fall out or anything or anything like that. He's just super busy and he doesn't really have the time at the current moment to commit, you know, to being on the podcast regularly. But we are going to hopefully get him on as a guest lots and lots in the future because we definitely want him to be a part of A Fortnight in Film still. It's just, like I said, he just time-wise, you know, doesn't have the time at the moment to be on it regularly, which is understandable because he's a very busy man with a lot of interesting hobbies and responsibilities that are far more important than recording an episode for this every fortnight. So in place of Christian, we have a new co-host for the podcast. So welcome to A Fortnight in Film, Jacob.
Hello, I'm Jacob. It's good to be on here. Yeah, absolutely.
It's good to have you on. So for context, Jacob and I have known each other since we were like 12 years old. So I know you, obviously, but the listeners don't know you. So give us a little intro about you, you know, what sort of films are you into, if you have any, you know, favorite directors, actors, genres, etc. Give us a little insight into the mind of Jacob.
Some of my favorite films, I love more, you know, obscure films. I love, you know, auteurism, you know, I love some Hitchcock, a bit of Quentin Tarantino. I haven't seen a lot of their stuff, just very specific films. Don't even get me started on David Lynch. I really love Eraserhead. I'm thinking maybe in a future episode, I'm going to choose Eraserhead. you know, things with like really good like subtext, sometimes dialogue. Dialogue can be powerful in a film for me, but sometimes a film can be completely silent. It can be about the imagery, the soundtrack, things like that. So favorite movie of all time will probably be Dead Alive / Brain Dead. Peter Jackson movie. It's from New Zealand, back in, I think, the 90s.
I didn't even know he did anything other than Lord of the Rings.
In the 90s. I don't know if he started in the late 80s or the 90s. Peter Jackson did some like cult classic sort of body horror.
I've already learned something new and you've only been on the podcast for like 2 minutes, so...
Well, I do try. Thanks, man. Yeah, so, yeah. I studied film at uni, so... hopefully I can sort of add a pinch of my sort of perspective, a little pizzazz sort of to this fantastic podcast.
And I was saying to you when I was pitching you on the idea of coming on board as a co-host that you were sort of like a very natural successor to Christian because you're alike in the same, you know, you're alike in a lot of ways, and but you can both, you know, talk about films in this very like analytical, in-depth, insightful way, and your tastes are like, you know, more like offbeat and obscure than someone like me.
I do appreciate your opinions. I love your opinions, Jason.
Good. I'm glad someone loves them.
We need that, man. Come on.
So shall we jump into it?
Yes, absolutely.
So we'll kick it off with my pick, which is The Game from 1997. Directed by Mr. David Fincher. So the plot is, so it stars Michael Douglas and Sean Penn, they're sort of the two main people, but it sort of revolves around, you know, Michael Douglas is like the main character for much of the film. So he plays someone called Nicholas Van Orton, who is this rich, I don't know if he's a million, well, I was going to say billionaire, but he's not. He says at one point he's worth 600 million. So he's a millionaire, multi-millionaire, investment banker. And he has lunch with his younger brother, Conrad, who's played by Sean Penn. Conrad says to him, oh, I've got you this birthday present, which is this game. It's sort of all he says to him. So he goes to the company who runs this game and he has to, you know, fill out all these forms and do all these tests. You know, it's not like a game as normal people would think of it. It's you know, it's never really explained what it is or what happens. It's all very secretive and mysterious. So he gets a call one day saying that he's been rejected from the, you know, his application was rejected and he's not going to take part. We soon learn this was not true, because it's actually the start of the game. So he gets home, like a clown, like a wooden clown outside of his house, which has a hidden camera in. And then like this person on the TV starts talking to him, who's like a, you know, he's like the news anchor, but he's also like a COS employee at the same time. He meets this waitress who's Christine, played by Deborah Carla Unger, and like she gets, you know, it seems at the start that she's just a random person caught up in all this, but you come to learn that, you know, she's also a COS employee. Yeah, COS is a company who runs this game.
Yeah, I think it was Consumer Recreational Services.
Yes.
Very official sounding, doesn't it?
Yeah, very vague, you know, name. So all this crazy shit starts happening. He gets into this taxi and it, you know, ends up crashing into the harbor with him inside, but he escapes. He goes to Christine and these, you know, gunmen attack the house. You know, she, once it's revealed, she's working for them. You know, she, like, we are believed as an audience, and Nicholas is believed that, you know, she's drained all his accounts and all his money's gone. He's like, you know, drugged and he's left in like Mexico, you know, and it's like buried alive thing. And it gets to the end of the film, and he finds the original guy who was like, who signed him up at the agency. He discovers that he's like an actor for like TV commercials. So he finds him and he you know, takes him at gunpoint and says, you know, take me to COS, because they've, where they were previously, like they've moved, like they've abandoned the office. It's like, they were never there. So he's like, take me to where they are. And he sees, you know, everybody that he's ever come across in the last, I mean, however long this thing goes on for, let's say the week, I don't know if it's actually said the time frame, let's say it's a week, everybody he's come into contact with in the past week is like there in the room, because they're all part of the game. And he goes to the roof and he says, you know, Christine's trying to talk him down and say, like, it's just a game, it's all fake, like none of it really happened, you know, it was all this elaborate prank and it was all, you know, like all your money's there, like your family's safe. Because the other thing too is he thought that his brother had, like, you know, been taken to some asylum or something. And Christine's like, no, it's all just like a big, like, joke. It's all just a game. The door opens and he shoots the first person who comes out, which happens to be Conrad. And then he thinks he's killed him. And so then he jumps off the roof. But he just happens to land in this big, like, inflatable air thing. You know, like, cushions just fall. And it's revealed that it is all a, you know, it is all a game, and it was all a big ruse for a birthday present. It was Conrad's birthday present to Nicholas, was taking part in this game, and the point of it was, you know, so he would become a, you know, better person and more appreciative and, you know, enjoy life instead of a miserable, cold existence that he was living previously. That's the gist of the film. I'm sure we could go into much more detail, and I'm sure we'll probably go into it in the gist of talking about it. I loved the film. I gave it 4.5 stars. It wasn't perfect. I do have my problems with it, which I'll get into, but overall I thought it was a pretty darn good film. Fincher is sort of quickly becoming one of my favorite directors. I mean, I've seen only six. I mean, he's only done like four, I want to say like 14 films or something. I've seen six of them and I've enjoyed pretty much all of them. I mean, I thought, you know, I gave Zodiac 4.5 stars. I gave Seven 4.5 stars. I thought Fight Club was good. I don't think it's as good as everyone acts like it is, but it was a good film. You know, The Social Network was great. And, like, you know, I really want to see Mank. I really want to see The Killer once it comes out. So he sort of quickly emerged as, certainly of the films I've seen of his recently, I've enjoyed a lot of them. But what did you think?
I thought the film was fantastic. I'm just going to knock it down 0.5 star. I gave it 4. But yeah, like, from the beginning to the end, you know, he seems like a very lonely guy, Nicholas. There was a lot of those flashbacks going back to his past, about the death of his father, to commit suicide. Tragic. Like, you don't want to see that ever.
Which is obviously the same circumstance. He jumped off a roof.
Yeah, yeah. Funnily enough, the actor that played his father, I've got the name of the of the actual father, because he didn't appear that much other than in the flashbacks, was Charles Martinet or Martinet. He does the voice of Super Mario. So I've met him. He's one of the nicest guys. Very warm individual. Yeah, so I was very surprised to see him doing, you know, an acting role in a very serious film. He's very lonely, this Nicholas, and he has a lot of money. And I think that this sort of like empty sort of loneliness equals rich guy kind of like thing that was going on. He seemed like a very orderly person. He was feels very in control of everything.
Yeah, which I think his brother says that to him at one point, like, you know, like, you're just mad because you're not, this is when they're like having an argument. He's like, you know, you're just mad because you're not in control of everything for once. Like,
absolutely. So he goes out and he gets this, yeah, as you said, this gift. And I think, yeah, we were taken for a ride as well alongside Nicholas. You think this is this game, and then it ends up being this game. He goes through so much stuff, and the twists and turns aren't just on him, it's on us as well. But I found through the movie, I was completely or almost completely blind to a lot of the symbolism. Say he's driving along, there's like this scene where he's driving along these sort of train track, well, you know, sort of not train track, tram tracks. And it's like a straight line. He drives off. There was another moment where he does that as well. And I think that that's supposed to imply that, you know, he's in order. A lot of the things that he does is almost like sort of like that orderly, symmetrical sort of thing. A lot of the framing and everything for a lot of the scenes, it went under the radar a lot for me through the movie. But then when it all started to tie up at the end, that was complete manipulation. It was manipulating him, other people around him that were didn't even know. I think that he's one of his like assistants, caretake, the maids. I think she didn't know what was going on. I'm not too sure if the ex-wife knew what was going on, but or the guy that owned the book. The book publishing, children's book publishing service, I'm pretty sure he didn't know what was going on. So I think there was a lot of manipulation there. And in the end, we were manipulated as well as an audience. Yeah, it was crazy. That ending just made the movie for me. He thought that this was it. This was fate. All the flashbacks, everything. The assessment, you know, with CRS is what led to that point. And they knew, like, basically every step he was going to take. I thought it was fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, like, I would agree a lot of what you said. I think this, like, one of the reasons I loved it so much is because of the point you just made of we're finding out along with him at the same time. Like, we don't have that extra knowledge, like, oh, we know what's going to happen. Like, we don't have a clue what's going to happen, and he doesn't have a clue what's going to happen. And some films can ruin that. Like, some films will give us too much knowledge and give the characters none. But like you said, we were manipulated the same way he was manipulated. I was on the edge of my seat the whole way through. Like, and that's what David Fincher's so good at. Like, he's so good at this mystery. Like, it's fast moving, but it's like slow revealing, if that makes sense, but it works. Like, Zodiac did that. Seven did that. Fight Club did that to an extent. So he's so good at that mystery and tension the whole way through. It just goes more and more and more. I mean, I thought Michael Douglas and Sean Penn were really good. I've seen Sean Penn in quite a few things, and he doesn't really disappoint me. I haven't seen Michael Douglas in a lot, but I thought he was really good in this, especially having to work with like such a, like you said, like a ordered, not robotic, but you know, just this sort of semi-emotionless, you know, doesn't really get like worked up about anything character to like have, you know, play that the way he did. I thought was good. Technically, I mean, I can't fault it. Like, the score was great, the cinematography was great, the script was great. Like, this was what I wished The Truman Show was. And, like, I liked that film, but I don't know if everyone raves about it, and I didn't think it was, like, rave-worthy. But that's what I wished this was, where it's like, you don't even know what's real. And, like, what is my reality? What is fake? What is... That's what I love this did so well. And I'm like, that's what I wished The Truman Show did. And I know that's different, too, because that's more of a comedy. This is obviously, like, a straight thriller.
Yeah, I was going to say The Truman Show is... very entertaining.
Right, whereas this is more like...
keeps you guessing, yeah.
Thrilling, and like, you're like, well, what's happening? Like...
yeah, what's happening next? What's going to happen to him? This guy is going to end up not trusting anyone at the end of this. He's lonely. He is not going to trust anyone by the end of this film.
No.
But then I think when it all happens at the end, you know, it brings him... He ends up apologizing to his wife, his ex-wife.
Yeah.
you know, after really not contacting, you know. So I think that the overall CRS goal is to bring that happiness right. at the end of the game, you know, in a certain way. So, yeah.
So onto that ending, I have a lot to say about it. And this was the reason why. And this is the thing with Fincher that I can't fucking stand. He has perfect films, and then you get to the final 5 and 10 minutes and he ruins it. He did it with Zodiac. He did it with Seven. He's done it with The Game. Now, I can't remember the exact endings of Zodiac and Seven in relation to why I didn't like them, because it was the endings. I was like, oh, these are 5-star films. And then it was the last 5, 10 minutes and I dropped a 0.5-star because I thought the endings were just stupid for whatever reason. With this ending, like, there were some twists that I saw coming, like, you know, like, for example, when he was drugged by Christine, like, I knew as soon as he drank that tea, I'm like, that's drugged. Like, even I know that's drugged.
Yeah.
Right. But there were others I didn't see. Like, when he walked into that, you know, he had like, guy, what's his name? Jim Feingold, who's played by James Webhorn, who was the, you know, the original guy who signed him up.
I loved his character, by the way. He was so, like, nonchalant.
Yeah. He's just like, I just work there. Like, I don't care.
Yeah. I just work here.
I'm just some hired actor.
Yeah. Just eating my Chinese food.
Like, when they walked into that cafeteria and you see everybody in there was a CRS, like, employee or paid by CRS, even you realize, like, there were people in the backgrounds of scenes.
Yeah, yeah.
Who were CRS employees. Like, when he's, like, when that, like, when after him and Connie have that argument, and, you know, Conrad runs off, and then the phone start ringing, and there's a phone, like, down in, like, the bit underneath the bridge or whatever, and there's some, like, bum there, and you see him, like, in the cafeteria, like, even he was in on it, and you're like, holy shit, like, is everybody in the film I've seen, like, a COS employee? Like, what is happening?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that the guy, again, that was running the book place, I feel like he wasn't in on it. I don't know. I don't remember seeing him in the room.
And it's hard to tell because obviously everybody was there at the end. The ex-wife was there. He was there. So it's like, you're like, oh, were they just invited there to be like, oh, there's this party. Or were they in on us? And like, that's the whole thing is you get to be in the film. Like, I don't even know who was in on it, who wasn't. I did figure that Conrad was behind it. I sort of got that from the jump. I was like, I realized once I realized what was going on, I'm like, okay, he's behind it. He's like, put it all together. My problem with the ending is, it's so, and I've got actually, I've got two comments I found on Reddit, which sort of sum up my views. And then someone responded sort of explaining, which I'm also going to read because I think they are valid. But before I get to that, it's like, you know, the fact that someone would go to all of this for what was essentially a birthday party was just absolutely ridiculous. And the, you know, the ending was supposed to be, oh, you know, you need to, you know, become a better person. You need to, like, embrace life. And I get it's a film, I know all that. But in what realm of possibility would anybody decide to go to these ends and inflict all this psychological trauma on someone and be like, oh, I hope at the end you're a better person? No, you're probably a fucking worse person at the end, because now their outlook has probably been so destroyed that you're going to have the opposite effect, you know? And then he gets to the end and he goes to Christine, oh, you know, let's go on a date. It's like, no one would ever go on a date with a person who just mind-fucked them for the past week. It's ridiculous. So it was like, I saw a comment someone made where they said, I was almost angry at the end that a movie that got me so invested ended in such a terrible way. It made me feel like I wasted my time. Like, that's how I feel, because I was so invested in it. And then the last, like, 10 minutes came, and I was like, this is so unbelievably stupid. I'm like, I was angry. I'm like, I invested all this time and all this mental effort, and then you have a stupid thing. Oh, you know, he jumps off a loop at the airbag was in the exact right location, and everybody there is celebrating. And he's celebrating. He's moved on from the fact of his psychological trauma in like 2 minutes, and oh, he's with a glass of champagne. I'm like, this is absolutely stupid.
Yeah, I had very similar thoughts. You know, I thought that he was going to jump off that building and just die.
That would have been a good ending.
Yeah,
that's what he
should
have done. He should have just jumped off a building, dead. That's it.
Kills his brother. Dead, exactly. Everybody, yeah, and everybody's sad, and then you walk out of the cinema in the 90s,
yeah,
and you're like, oh my god, that
would have been a fantastic ending, because then, you know,
everyone's sad,
yeah.
Yeah, so that twist, and then and then everybody partied. That's what got me. As soon as I saw the band start playing and there was all smiles on their faces, you know, But hey, you know, a lot of these because the budget was very, very large. It was $50 million for the budget. So when you think a really big movie, they want that like payoff and then the happy ending and everybody to be happy at the end of the film. I think there's a lot of those big budget movies that want that a lot of the time. There's less of that sort of, you know, that's it. You know, we're just going to kill them off. That's the end expression, you know. Yeah, and then the love at the end. Because what's a story without there being like, you know, they lived happily ever after and then it abruptly cuts and you don't see the next scene, you know. Maybe in the next, if there's ever a sequel, you know. They're like together and then, you know, something else ridiculous happens and maybe someone does die in the end.
Maybe it can
know.
Be like The Game, The Revenge, and then like, like Nicholas and Axis elaborate plot on Conrad for like, you know.
And it's like B grade. And they find like this actor looks just like Michael Douglas. Like not just like a little bit off and like, you know, it's ridiculous. AI. You know? Yeah, it's AI. Oh god, they didn't get me started, man, on AI. But,
so I'm gonna read these couple comments. They are long, yeah. But it basically sums up what I think, and then also I think to give credit, it sort of explains a bit about I think what Fincher was trying to do. So the first one says, "I understand what actually happened. The COS game was real. Conrad was behind it, and all the events of the film were orchestrated by them to lead to the suicide/dinner party ending. My confusion is what all this was meant to achieve. Conrad says he gave Nicholas the game because he had become an asshole, and the COS rep from the beginning said their games gave people what was missing. It's clear what's missing from Nicholas' life. He is distant and lonely like his father, and he's afraid he'll suffer the same suicidal end. So, ostensibly, the game was meant to make Nicholas a better person, able to connect and appreciate people more. My question is how? The entire game was basically a psychological torture that made him fear for his life and slowly go insane. He loses everything, including his grip on reality, until jumping off a roof with a full expectation of dying. Cue the reveal, the applause with champagne. Everyone seems to think Nicholas has gained something invaluable, including Nicholas, but it feels entirely unearned. Basically, does this movie make any coherent sense to anyone who's seen it? How was this game supposed to make Nicholas a better person? Was it even a success? I don't even understand why he's happy at the end. Why isn't he still pissed? They tortured him." So then I basically agree with all of that. And then someone responded and said, "It wasn't just to make him a vague, better person. It was to help him come to terms with why his father killed himself. What would make him do such a thing? It's not fully developed in the movie, and quite frankly, it can't be because of what a rabbit hole psychology is, and a movie's only 2 hours. But Nicholas had problems with being close to his people, e.g. alone on his birthday, estranged from his ex-wife and brother, and lived in a bit of the echoes of his father's tragic shadow. In this version of the How Do We Reach Nicholas, let's oversimplify it and say his problem is that he needs to come to terms with why his father committed suicide. Not that he's afraid he'll suffer the same suicidal end, but that he doesn't actually know what would drive someone to do such a thing. Were the family and kids that bad? Was Nicholas to blame? Regardless of the answers, these are deep-seated psychological blueprints that rattle around in the heads of people what makes up their character and what always demand an answer that might never arrive. So to help him understand his father's suicide, COS creates a world where Nicholas is not in control, the opposite of his upbringing and current life. He absolutely cannot think his way out of it. It's a Kafkaesque nightmare of loose footing where he doesn't know up from down. They need to break him. Then when he's broken, they push him further and make him feel responsible for the loss of a loved one. Then, after losing his final emotional connection to anyone, he attempts suicide just as his father did. He gets it now, that burning hole in his heart doesn't have to poison every interaction anymore, doesn't have to skew his personality, it can release him." But that was quite an interesting explanation. And then on a separate Reddit thread, someone commented another thing, saying, "He jumped down the exact spot where they prepared the glass and placed the cushion. Okay, it's extremely unlikely he chooses the one spot to jump where he doesn't die, but I could let Fincher get away with this with some suspension of disbelief." But then Nicholas stands up, explained to him it was all just a prank and he's cool with it. What the fuck? He went through hell the last couple of days and made him believe he killed his brother, and that hit him so hard he wanted to kill himself. Not only does he forgive everyone and just celebrates his birthday with the people who are responsible for the most terrible time of his life, he also pays voluntarily half of a massive bill and goes on a date with a woman who did this to him. If it was me, I would never in my life see anyone involved in this again. It's absolutely unbelievable how Nicholas reacted in the end. It's still a great movie, but next time I watch it, I'll just stop it right after he jumps down the building. And so someone responded and said, "It's the point of the movie. It's a suicide intervention by his brother. The game as a gift for his 48th birthday. 48 is the same age that his father was when he killed himself. I don't actually know where they got that from, by the way, but apparently that's what they say. The point of the game was to strip Nick of everything that made him like his father and realize how good life is. Tellingly, one of the last things he does in the game is to pawn the watch that his father gave him to get back to the States, literally breaking his last physical attachment to his dad. Nick was contemplating suicide, so the game made him actually do it by throwing himself off a building. Once he goes through the virtual act of suicide, he realizes that he has so much to live for. So I thought there were some, you know, interesting explanations to a couple of comments that, you know, basically resonated with me a lot. The ending ruined it for me, but after reading those comments, I'm like, I can sort of understand where Fincher was coming from and why it happened in the way it did, but I still think it would have been a 5-star movie if it had had that bleaker ending where he shoots Conrad and he jumps off a building, film ends. We don't get a do-over, it's a film we've got. But, still a fantastic film. Definitely recommend a watch. Shall we move on to your pick, your first pick of a podcast?
So my pick was a very current film.
Still in cinemas.
The reason why I chose this film is because I found that it was slightly, unconventional. It was like an independent film, A24. I think they've been pumping out some really good films recently. A lot of people aren't. You're very divided with some of their recent films, like Everything Everywhere All at Once. People are very divided because that one was very hard to, I think, for some people to follow. It was very erratic. The right word is erratic. So The Whale, I think it started off very slow, but then up until the end, but I won't mention the ending yet. So the film is actually about, it's Brendan Fraser. It's his, what do they call it? His comeback, his renaissance, starring Brendan Fraser as Charlie, who is, you know, as they say, he's the whale. The film starts with a very, with a bombardment of confrontation. He is sitting he is very large, so he's sitting in his living room, and he's masturbating to pornography. A bit more context, I suppose, is the fact that he is a morbidly obese, homosexual college teacher. He had run away from his wife, Mary, and daughter, Ellie, for a man. The man's name is Alan, and Alan commits suicide because of this severe guilt, because he was a very religious person, and the church, he ended up committing suicide. So obviously Charlie is very depressed, and he turns to eating. He may have already had an eating disorder previously, because in pictures you see him with Alan. He's has a bit of a belly, so he can't really do too much. He has no hope. You can feel that in, like, the setting is, it's all based around his home, and you can tell from that mise en scène, there's mold on the ceiling. There's books piling up. It looks dirty. You know, there's food wrappers, stuff like that all around his apartment. You know, the usual thing, you know, that you may think that someone that doesn't care, you know, about their surroundings as much, would bother cleaning up. The main thing about the story is that the daughter comes back into the picture, and she finds him absolutely grotesque. All that Charlie wants is to connect with his daughter. So he has all of this money. He says, look, I will help you with your studies I'll give you all of this money. And she very reluctantly takes up that offer. So she's there, she's disgusted. She's like that sort of rebel archetype, doesn't care, smokes weed. An absolute, you know, villain of the story, if you want to think about it that way. You know, he eventually ends up taking pictures of Charlie and putting it on the internet, which I think is the reason why this film has a lot of, people are condemning it for fat shaming. But what I find about this film is that it shows you the epitome of someone that is very depressed and lets himself go with a sort of an eating disorder and inflicts self-harm through their eating disorder and just doesn't care. You know, he's on the brink of dying, you know, heart failure. The complexities of the relationship of Ellie and Charlie come to fruition. There's an essay that Ellie wrote about Moby Dick, and he thinks it's the best essay he has ever read because it's honest, and he is all about honesty. And he says that, you know, in the end, that, you know, it's all about honesty. He throws his laptop after telling showing his entire class who he is, and seeing the disgust on their face. And he just wanted them to be honest. In the end, I don't like to be nitpicky about the film, because I think that just the way the acting was fantastic throughout, you know, Brendan Fraser, excellent performance. When he says the only thing that he cares about in life is his daughter, and that she's amazing. He just sees this complete other side of life, just probably sitting there contemplating, you know. By the end, he gets his daughter to read this essay to him, and he finally stands up and walks over to Ellie. Or up until there, they could have cut it, you know, and then went straight, but they had to do that sort of moving up into the light sort of situation. After all the tears of that moment at the end of the film, you know, where Ellie has the light behind her and she's in tears and he's about to die and she reads that essay, you know, everything just all made sense in the end, but then just him rising up and making a weird noise. And then it's end credits. That just made me laugh. I thought that was so obscure. But then again, I love that kind of thing. So I think, you know, the whole film was just like almost like a semi-body horror kind of thing because of just how he looked. You know, I won't lie about that, but it's a very real situation for a lot of people, you know, and I think there isn't very many movies out there like The Whale. So I think that the message that put out there, you know, was very, very, very heavy. I gave The Whale probably a 4.5. Just, I mean, sometimes it's about the ambience, the ambiance, and a lot of those moments where nobody even needed to say anything. Online, he's reading up about the heart issues that he's having, and he just starts eating a whole heap of chocolate bars, and you know, just it's confronting. But I love movies that just are just confronting, you know what I mean? It's definitely an art. So what do you think of the movie, Jason?
Well, I hated this movie. so I gave it 1 star.
Yes.
So not off to a good start with you being on the podcast, but I mean, it was the same in Christian with you, it's the same with George. You know, a lot of times I don't like other people's picks. It's the same with guests we've had on, so don't take it personally, but I don't like your film.
I'm very keen to hear your opinion on this one.
Look, going in, I sort of knew, I wasn't like mad you made me watch it, because I sort of wanted to see it anyway, because, you know, everyone on Letterboxd has, you know, seen it and talking about it, and I wouldn't have gone out of my way to see it had we not had to watch it for this, but I also, there was a part of me that I did want to see it anyway, because everybody was just talking about it. I knew going in that I probably wouldn't like it, which I know you shouldn't go into. It's like, I try and keep an open mind, but, you know, I think we're all guilty if we go into certain films, oh, I think I'm going to love this, or I think I'm going to hate this, or, you know, I don't know how I'm going to react to this, you know, because we obviously know our own biases or our own preferences or our own, you know, like what we like in films, what we don't like, etc. For me, it was a mix of things. I didn't, so, you know, in terms of like, maybe I'll get to a story in a sec, but like, the acting, for instance, I've not really seen, I know people like, and I think it's more so now that he's sort of like come back with The Whale, that people are like, oh my god, Brendan Fraser is such a good actor. If I look at the films I've seen him in, other than The Whale, that's actually the first film I've seen him in, is The Whale.
Right. You haven't seen George of the Jungle?
No, you know, I never saw him in all those, you know, people love him in The Mummy and stuff, like, I never saw any of that. You know, it's visited my first Brendan Fraser film, so I can't, like, testify to, like, you know, what he's like as an actor, because this is the first time I've seen him. Although I do own a few other films he's in. One is called Crash, which is fairly famous from 2004. And then a couple others, one, A Case of You in 2013, and 20 Bucks in 1993. But I've not seen any of those three films. I just own them, but I haven't come down and watched them. So anyway, I didn't really think Brendan Fraser, I mean, look, Brendan Fraser was good, but I wouldn't say he's like amazing, you know. And I don't think he was good enough to like save the film, in my opinion. Sadie Sink, who plays his daughter in the film, Ellie, like, I love her in Stranger Things. She plays Max in Stranger Things. And I love Stranger Things. So I wanted to like her because I'm like, it's Max from Stranger Things. And I mean, she was better as Max. That's all I can say. And I didn't think Ty Simpkins, who plays Thomas, who's like this Christian missionary, or Hong Chow, who plays Liz, who's like, who is both the nurse of Charlie, like she comes to his house and looks after him, and she's also the sister of Alan, who was his boyfriend. And then it's also, she's interrelated to like Thomas because her adoptive father is the, is like the head of this church that he pretends to be from, so it's all like interlinked. Anyway, I didn't think that Ty Simpkins or Hong Chow were good. I mean, I say, I know everybody was raving online about them, but I didn't really think they were good. I will actually give credit to the actress who played Mary, Samantha Morton, who is the ex-wife of Charlie and Ellie's mother. I did think she was only in it briefly towards the end, but I did think when she was on screen she was good. But yeah, look, for acting, I wasn't particularly a fan of. Across the board, I mean, technically, I'm not going to say it's a bad film, but there weren't really technical elements that, like, stood out for me. I was like, oh, that was really good. So, look, in terms of a story, I guess, you know, it's tough. I mean, I don't know, maybe I'm interested to get your perspective on this too, because obviously we're both, you know, Australian, we both live in Australia, and it's a similar situation for George, in that we, in countries like Australia and the UK and a lot of Europe, really, you know, like, it said throughout the film, well, Liz says to him constantly, you know, like, you're dying, you need to go to the hospital, right? And he always says, oh, no, I can't go, you know, I'll be in debt, I'll be, like, $50,000 in debt, right? And that's obviously not something that any of us can relate to, because obviously here in Australia, we have Medicare. I know in the UK, they have the NHS, you know, in a lot of Europe, they have, you know, socialized healthcare and, you know, different things. So it's not something that I feel like we as people can relate to. I feel like if you're an American, you can probably be like, oh my god, that's so true, because, you know, obviously we've heard things about what the American healthcare system's like, but people like you and I, we haven't, you know, we don't have to worry about getting $50,000, $100,000, $200,000 in debt for going to the hospital. So it's sort of difficult to, I guess, relate or empathize from that perspective, because the whole time you're just like, go to the fucking hospital, you know, like we can't wrap our heads around this thing of, oh, we'll rack up $10,000 in debt, because for us, we just go to the hospital. But, you know, the thing with me is, his whole thing is honesty, right? That's a big thing of his thing throughout the film, is, you know, he tells the students, you know, you be honest in your writing, he tells Ellie, be honest, you know, in what you're writing, etc. But the thing is, he can't, in a sense, be honest with himself, you know. It's like he, because the thing is, he's not stupid. He knows why he's gotten the way he is, but he doesn't do anything about it, which is the frustrating part. And I know you can always talk about this thing of a hospital, you know, whatever else, but it's like, it's not as if he's gotten to be, you know, 600 pounds or whatever he is. I don't know what that is in kilograms. We don't use pounds in this country, but it's a lot. So it's not as if he's gotten to that point and he's sort of gone, oh, I don't know, why has this happened? Like, he's very aware of why it's happened, you know, but it's like, he sort of can't, like, this is the frustrating thing, is he has the self-awareness to sort of extricate himself from the situation, but he doesn't. And I feel like even if this, you know, health, you know, hospital debt thing wasn't hanging over his head, I feel like he still wouldn't take those steps, right, to, like, not die. And so you just feel like screaming at the screen, it's like, do something, you know, because it's like, he's a smart guy, like, he's a college professor who teaches English, like, he's not dumb. That was something that just bothered me throughout, is just this inability of, like, he knows what he has to do, but he refuses to do it for whatever reason.
I think when it comes to, like, depression and eating disorders, it's very hard to get yourself out of that sort of, out of that hole. And I suppose the character that he's portraying seems to be selfless, not selfish. You'd think there is that sort of, I feel like his character, Charlie's character, almost tries to combat that with, like, you know, how you see, you know, it's like that whole idea of the controversies and fat shaming. You know, there's like this sociocultural idea that people that are really large are selfish. They just consume, they just sit down and do everything, you know, like extreme hedonism, all that sort of stuff. But I think that just the character that he does portray, he does care about other people. There's, I think one of the lines that he says, although I do disagree with the line to some extent, because there are such things as sociopaths out there. People are incapable of not caring. People are amazing. You know, when he says that, it's supposed to be like the one.
Which again, I also disagree, because there's a lot of people out there who don't care about anybody else and never will. But I get his point of what he's trying to make, because like I said, he's a selfless person. He is an optimist. He is a person who deliberately chooses to see the good in the world.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And of course, the stuff that's happened in his life, you know, you lose hope, you know, you're in love, you ran away from your family, and the family also thinks that he's completely selfish, you know, the daughter and the mother, you know, they try to combat that too, where he pretty much shows throughout that he's sorry, like, I'm sorry that I've ran away from you, I was in love, and sometimes love is one of the most powerful things. A lot of things going in the brain, you know, oxytocin, dopamine, you know, you're just like, almost like an ant, you know, how ants are just like, they're just almost robotic. It's just this impulse, neurochemical impulse. When you're in love, you protect and anyway, so I digress. I think that just showing that someone that is the, again, using the word epitome, or not epitome, but what people would assume to be the form of greed, isn't greedy. I suppose there is depictions of fat shaming from the daughter, the putting pictures on the internet, things like that. And of course, even the students, when he shows students who he is, they seem to be disgusted because of this sociocultural idea that that's disgusting. But again, from the beginning of the film to the end, I think the character grows as like, you think, oh, wow. But by the end, you're kind of like, well, personally, I'm kind of like, this person is, it's a person. He's a person, just like, you know, and a lot of people don't think that way when it comes to really large people. And people don't understand sometimes that people that are in that deep depression and in that hole, it is hard to lose the weight. But you have a very good point with the health system over there in America as well. It's crazy. It's too expensive. They have nothing.
That's a whole nother, yeah.
That's a whole nother kettle of fish.
We could do a whole episode about that. But
yeah, yeah, absolutely.
And, you know, Christian works in the health system, so I'm sure he would have comments on that as well. But
yeah, absolutely. But I think the cultural idea, you know, if it's an American film, you think it's America, so, you know, it wouldn't happen. We can't relate to it, but I think, you know, sort of cultural knowledge of America, you would think that's unfortunate.
The only two things I would add is I would push back on your point about the thing where he's like, oh, you know, I was in love, just because I'm so, and I see this in so many films, and I've talked about it on the podcast before, but I hate any film that like excuses cheating and infidelity. It's like, I was in love. I'm like, well, if you are, then, you know, there's ways to go about it that isn't like abandoning your wife and daughter and like, I haven't seen her in 10 years. Like, yeah, anyway, I'm just very, like, I hate films that, like, try and, like, legitimize cheating and being like, I was in love, and I'm like, that's actually not an excuse. But that's just a minor point, but I did want to raise it.
I totally understand. I think the impulse of some people, I think, you know, it makes for a good film sometimes, infidelity, affairs. What do you think soap operas are about?
Well, there's so many films that talk, you know, affairs in the title. And just for me, the ending, you know, like, the ending was so cliche. You know, it's like the game. Like, you know, you mentioned, like, you know, oh, they have to have this, you know, this happy ending. They have to have, oh, you know, she's the romance and da-da-da. And in this one, it was like, Ellie, the character of Ellie, was such a horrible, like, remorseless bitch for the whole film. It's like absolutely nasty individual, just like no empathy whatsoever, like cruel, you know, like a manipulative.
She needs to be taught a lesson.
All this stuff, and then it gets to the end, and she's like, yeah, you know, and she turns around and she's showing remorse. I'm like, you don't have the capacity for remorse. You are a horrible little child, and it's like, oh, I found the ending so cliche in just, you know, the way her character, like, redeemed herself, because there were no indications of that throughout the film. There was, like, she was this horrible person, and then you get to the end, and she's like, oh, I love you now. But it's like, you spent the whole film rejecting him and telling him how horrible he is, so, you know, like, do you really love him, or did whatever his name is, who directed this?
I don't remember. It was Darren Aronofsky. Yeah,
that's what I thought it was. Yeah. Did Darren Aronofsky just put it in there, like, you know, this happy ending sort of thing? I mean, I don't know. I like happy endings. You know, I'm not a miserable person, but I like happy endings when they're not forced. You know, and I felt like the game's ending was forced. I felt like this ending was forced. I feel like a lot of directors, and I mean, I know Aronofsky's done, you know, he's done, and I think this is, if I look at what other films I've seen of his, this is the third. I mean, I've seen The Wrestler, which I thought was amazing, 5 stars, and I saw The Fountain, which I thought was all right. But I'm not saying that Aronofsky is not, like, doesn't take risks. I mean, I've certainly heard, I own Black Swan, I haven't seen it, but I've heard that is a, like, maybe the ending of that film, you know, is a bit bleak. I've heard, you know, Mother, Requiem for a Dream, etc. So I'm not saying he's, like, unafraid to do it. I don't like when directors, and I haven't actually seen any of his films, so I can't just, you know, I don't know what their endings are. But I don't like when directors, like, take the easy way out, you know, and don't have the sort of bravery to be like, oh, let's end this with the guy really killing his brother and jumping off a building, or with this guy dying and his daughter still hates him. You know, they have to, like, retro it and be like, oh, it's happy ending, and everyone is happy after. And I'm like, that's not life in a lot of cases. You know, like, that's a movie. A lot of times, if it was real life, the daughter wouldn't, you know, she would walk out of there and, oh, you know, good, I'm glad you've died sort of thing.
I wasn't expecting, you know, her taking pictures of him and her taking pictures of, Ty Simpkins' characters, Thomas. I wasn't expecting that. And then I wasn't expecting how he sent pictures of Thomas smoking marijuana, like smoking weed to his family, and then him going back. And still Charlie saw this whole, you know, oh, she was doing the right thing. You know, that was, I think she had ill intention when it came to sending the pictures and putting the pictures online, you know. But there was a point where I thought she wasn't going to be all completely evil. I thought she was going to flip, you know. And obviously it got to the end of the movie and I was sure she was about to. And I was like, no, she's not. She's still an absolute bee, you know. It all happens and then she breaks. And that's what I saw in that, you know. I understand, you know, I totally respect your opinion with that. But again, you know, film is an art form. People see it in different ways, different perspectives, you know, based on all different things. But what I saw is that she broke. She was like, I do care about you. She wants nothing but Charlie, you know, her father to be well, to not run away. And he did die. It is a movie where someone dies in the end. That ending is just, and then like the waves and the beach. It's very poetic. I thought it was very poetic. The juxtaposition of it being Moby Dick, an essay about Moby Dick. And if you've seen the end of Moby Dick where the whale comes up out of the water, I think that's supposed to be sort of a juxtaposition of that.
Well, on that note, shall we move on to our final pick for the podcast?
Yes.
Final film.
Absolutely. An absolute classic.
Yes, this is George's pick. So we have actually talked about this film once on the podcast before. George actually talked about it in our first ever episode, all the way back in September of 2021, we had a totally different format where we'd talk like, oh, what are the best films you saw in the past fortnight? What are the worst films, etc.? And this was his pick for like best film. But the problem with that format was oftentimes we're talking about films the other person hadn't seen. So we were just sort of talking like, oh, I saw this really good film, this is why I love it. And the other person can't, you know, they couldn't contribute anything because they hadn't seen it. So like I hadn't seen Psycho at that point. I mean, obviously I knew about it as anybody who's not even into film, you know, even people who never, you know, don't consider themselves a fan of movies would know Psycho. So I couldn't really contribute anything to that discussion. We're talking about it again. George picked it for us to watch from 1960, directed by Alfred Hitchcock. It's very highly rated on, well, I was going to say on Letterboxd, but everywhere. I mean, on Letterboxd, it's sitting at a 4.3 average. It's number 83 and the top 250 on there. I'm sure it's at the top of many other lists across the world to do a film. So the plot is Janet Leigh, who funnily enough is sort of advertised, you know, really heavily, like, you know, she's like on the poster and she's in the, you know, the start of, and she ends up making, you know, she's not a really, well, I mean, on screen, she's not really a big part of the film, but I guess her character and what happens to her character obviously drives the whole plot forward. So she works as a real estate secretary, and she's called Marion Klein, and she's got this boyfriend who's in all this debt, and you know, they can't get married because he's in all this debt. And so it so happens that this guy comes in wanting to buy this house, and he gives them $40,000 in cash because he's some, you know, big shot guy who wants to show off, you know, oh, I have all this money, I'm going to pay you in cash. Oh, aren't I big deal? So she decides to steal the cash and runs off with it. In the midst of driving off, she stops for the night at a hotel called the Bates Motel, where Norman Bates, who's played by Anthony Perkins, comes out. He runs the hotel or the motel. She stays the night. They talk. She overhears like his mother complaining about her being there. Like, I mean, you know, the mother doesn't really approve. So the next morning I think it's about night. She takes a shower in probably one of the most famous scenes in film history. And somebody stabs her to death in the shower, with the music and the knives and the screaming. Norman, you know, cleans it up and sinks the body and her car and all the stuff in a swamp. Her sister doesn't hear from her for like a week. She goes to the boyfriend and says, what's happening? Like, you know, she's stolen this money. No one knows where she is. And at the same time, there's a private investigator who's also been put on a case, presumably by who she worked for, to recover the money. And so they all sort of team up, and he, his name's Arbogast. He's played by Martin Balsam. He goes to question Norman. It starts out, you know, like he's very normal, and he's like, oh, you know, no one has come through here. And then slowly, you know, it's revealed that, oh, yes, she did stay there. And, oh, yes, you know, she talked with him, and blah, blah, blah. Arbogast sort of figures, okay, something's not right, like his story's fishy. So he goes to the house, because there's like the 12 motel rooms, and then Norman Bates lives, presumably with his mother, in this house up on this hill, sort of overlooking the property. And Arbogast thinks that Marion spoke to Norman's mother. So he goes to, you know, this mansion to talk to the mother, and he gets stabbed, killed. Sam, who's the boyfriend, and Lila, who's the sister, they figure, oh, something must have happened to Arbogast, because we even heard from him. So then they go to the motel. And they figure out before that, so they go to the sheriff, and he tells them that the mother died 10 years earlier. So it's not possible that anybody spoke to the mother, or that Norman lives with his mother, because the mother's dead. They go to the motel and try to get some answers out of him. And while Sam, the boyfriend, distracts Norman, Lila goes into the house, and she goes down to the basement and sees what she thinks is Norma Bates' mother. But it turns around and it's a skeleton. It's not, you know, she's dead. She's obviously been dead. And he's just kept a, you know, decaying corpse in the house for 10 years. And he goes to kill her, but Sam sort of discovers him in time, and they subdue him. And then it basically gets to the end where a psychiatrist is, you know, evaluating him. And he says Norman and his mother were very close because, like, his father died when he was 5, but then his mother got married to this other man, and Norman was jealous because he wasn't getting all the attention anymore, and so he killed them both. And then because he felt guilty, he like mummified his mother's corpse and was treating it like she was still alive and not dead. And then he like became his mother in a sense, like he would, you know, dress up like her and act like her. And, you know, like the times in the film when we as an audience saw him speaking to his mother, it was obviously just him having a conversation with himself. Like two, you know, alternate personalities, and the film ends. I gave it 4 stars. I thought it was a solid film. I don't think it's one of the best films ever, like so many other people think, but certainly it's a solid horror. It's only the second Hitchcock film I've seen. The only one I've seen apart from this is North by Northwest, which I gave 4.5 stars to, but I do own like 15 of his films, so I just need to get around to watching them, because obviously Hitchcock is obviously one of the, you know, most iconic directors ever. So look, I thought it was great, but I do have my problems with it. What did you think?
Well, Psycho is an absolute classic. I think it stands alone. Some people have probably seen Psycho and they don't even know who doesn't really know Hitchcock, really? But it stands alone. The only other Hitchcock movies I've really seen is Frenzy. It's about a serial killer, that strangles women.
Seems to have a thing, Hitchcock, about serial killers killing women.
Yeah.
Maybe someone should do, a psychoanalytic study on him. I'm sure
Yeah.
Freud or someone would have had a lot to say about him.
Absolutely. I think it might be a bit difficult now, but I think it's interesting that he always has women, like women killers, things like that. He does a lot of movies with birds in them.
Be famously adapted for birds by Daphne du Maurier.
There's a lot of imagery, in the motel, the stuffed animal birds, naturally, because Norman Bates, as a child, would got into stuffing animals, taxidermy, and you would assume that he would have taxidermied his mother too. And a lot of the issues that he had as a child, he's what the psychologist was mentioning. The film from the beginning, you would think that Marion is the protagonist, the protagonist, and then Norman Bates would be the antagonist. But it's pretty much all about the antagonist and not the protagonist, because she ends up dying. It's very interesting, that iconic scene with the knife and a stabby stabby. The noise that it makes also sounds like a bird to me. Have you ever made that connection?
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't have to rewatch that scene and see, but
It just sounds like squawk, squawk, squawk. The symbolism of birds, I think. Back in the day, you would call women birds.
some people still do.
So yeah, some people obviously still do. The fact that he was able to, she stayed the night, like a bird in a cage. Birds represent freedom as well, and she's almost stuck within her own moral, immoral actions.
Well, and she's sort of stuck within a cage of her own doing because
Yeah.
she's stolen this money, and so it's like, what's she gonna do?
She flew into a cage. It's like she was free, with this money, and she flies straight into, like, basically a cage, and then pictures on the walls and everything, birds all around. So yeah, Hitchcock was a big fan of birds. Yeah, I would give Psycho 4.5, 5 stars. I think going back to that time too, the fact that it was so controversial and, like, something different. That was very different to a lot of the films at that time. I'll take that into consideration. I suppose the only issue that I would have, well, two issues. One of the issues, it was in black and white. Although, see, at the time, I'm pretty sure you could film in color, but it was cheaper to do it in black and white. And not so much that it's an issue, it's just that, because it adds to the ambiance, it adds to the movie, absolutely. Imagine if it was in color. But the other issue was the psychologist or psychiatrist, whatever you want to call him, at the end. He was like a big explainer. It's like he knew everything and everybody trusted him. Everybody listened to him. Nobody objected. He was just like, this is exactly what it is. This is exactly what happened. The mother lives inside Norman Bates. I've watched the film before and I thought this is a very similar thing, and it's been many years since I have seen it. But yeah, I had a very similar thought, the. He just holds the room and he just explains everything. This was your it's like a end of Scooby-Doo. It was like a Scooby-Doo episode. But again, it was very entertaining, and sometimes to conclude, to have that closure at the end of the film, it's good to know everything that's going on. In that con I think in this film it works.
Yeah, so like just on that point, I mean, I appreciate his like explanation because it helped like connect all the dots and provide motive. Because you figure out what's going on, okay, cool, he's the mother and he's the one who's been doing the killing. But I guess, and especially audiences of that time, I would say wouldn't have. But even now, you're like, okay, but why? And so I appreciated that explanation. And I think probably why, like you said, everyone just listened to him and trusted him was because I'd say in 1960 when this came out, or if it's even, I don't know when it's set. I presume it's set sort of a time it came out. Especially in that day and age, things like psychiatrists, psychologists, whatever, were, like authorities. It's not like now where sort of everybody considers themselves, a personal walking expert on mental health and everything else, and like people are, you know a lot more. Like back in those days, the only people who knew about that stuff was psychiatrists or psychologists.
That is a really good perspective. Yeah.
So look, I'll just say a few nitpicky things first before I actually get on to what I enjoyed. So you know, in the start, you know, when she's driving, I know it was especially when she was driving. It might have even been before that, but I can't remember. Where like she can like hear, you know, like what the characters are saying, but she's not there. I was like, it's a minor thing, but I was like, that's so stupid. I'm like, there's no, it didn't add anything to the film to me. I'm like, what is she, like a telepath now, as well as a thief? Like, wow, amazing.
I think that was more like, she's driving along, she's feeling guilty, she's thinking. I don't think she was actually hearing it. I feel like it was like, you know, meanwhile, they're talking, which was an interesting effect. It was different.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it was just, they weren't saying anything you wouldn't expect. Like they were saying, oh, I can't believe she's taken the money. Oh, something must have happened. Yeah, like it wasn't like they were like, you know, I don't know. It's a minor thing. It didn't affect the film for me at all. I just thought it was a stupid thing that was included. In terms of the ending itself, like the very ending, I actually wish the film ended, because like if it's like, I just give this whole explanation or whatever, and then Norman is in like his jail cell and you hear like his voice, or like is actually his mother's voice in that sense, like him as his mother saying, you know, oh, it was all me, you know, but nobody suspected me, which I love that speech. When you see that, like, you see that iconic scene of him, you know, looking at the camera and he's smiling, and I wish it just ended there, because then it cut to like, oh, the car was being dragged out of the swamp. I was like, no, I don't care. It just ended on that scene where he's, you know, smiling at the camera, done. End film. But again, that was a minor thing. It didn't affect anything for me in terms of how I viewed the film. I just wish it had ended on that shot, because I think that would have been a fantastic final shot, as opposed to dragging the car out of the swamp, which means nothing in the grand scheme of things, because they know the car's in the swamp. They know she's dead.
Well, unfortunately, it wasn't the end. There were several sequels.
I've heard that. I didn't even know until you told me that there were all these sequels. I thought it was just like a one-off. I mean, I know Hitchcock didn't do any of them, but I didn't. I was shocked that there were any sequels. I thought it was just, you know, a standalone film and that was it. And when you said to me, oh, there's always sequels, I thought, oh, I never knew.
I think because, yeah, it probably should have ended with just the original. But I think it's when Hitchcock passed in 1980. It was like 1983 or something that Psycho 2 came out, and it was directed by an Australian director.
Oh, there you go, one of us.
His name is Richard Franklin. So Psycho 2 was directed by him in the 80s, and obviously Hitchcock passed away and they thought, well, we own the rights, let's make all these movies. But I think the third one was directed by Anthony Perkins as well. So maybe he was just out of a job at that point. I don't know. I'm not too sure. I don't follow him as an actor, but I watched them quite a while ago, so I can't remember them too well. So they're very not memorable.
And I also think, you know, it'd be hard match for any sequel to, you know, match this, whether in terms of content or impact that it had on film. I mean, yes, this was actually the first Anthony Perkins film I've seen. I thought he was fantastic. Janet Leigh was all right. I said she wasn't in it. You know, she was only in the first, what, half an hour, 45 minutes or whatever. But look, everyone else was, you know, good. I can't really complain about any of the acting, you know, Vera Miles, who played a sister, and John Gavin, who played a boyfriend. I thought they were good. Martin Balsam, I thought was good. I've seen him in a few things before. I thought he was very good in 12 Angry Men, which George and I have discussed in the podcast. So, like, yeah, I thought he was good. Like, yeah, so I can't really fault any of the acting. Technically, I mean, it's Hitchcock. So, I mean, of course, it's fantastic. I thought the score was fantastic. I do think it was a bit, like, overbearing at times. It was just, like, constant the whole way through. And I was just a bit like, oh, can we just have no music for, like, 5 or 10 minutes? But, I mean, it was very good. I mean, the cinematography, of course, you know, Hitchcock was the master of the camera. You know, like, you know, his slow panning shots, all these like unique camera angles he used.
There is a reason why that's a very iconic scene in the bathroom.
Right. Well, you know, that transition there where it went from like the drain to like her eye when she's dead, or like that scene of where you hear Norman talking to who you believe to be his mother, and it sort of like pans, it like goes up the stairs, and then the camera sort of shifts to where like you never see inside the bedroom to where, you know, they're talking. So at this point in the film, you're still thinking, oh, she's exists, you know, she's a person, and she's, you know, he's in there talking to his mother, and you just see the door, but the camera sort of moves in this interesting way. And when you're looking at it from like above, and he's carrying his mother's body out, and you think, oh, that's just his mother's body, you know, you didn't know that it's a corpse.
Yeah.
So just like all these interesting camera angles, you know, like just like the way the film position it to where you thought the mother was alive, because you never saw her until that final reveal at the end, you know, when the corpse, you know, turns around. The writing, you know, I mean, I don't know if Hitchcock wrote this. No, it was actually written by someone called Joseph Stefano. But just the way it was written in, like, and, like, I picked up on it at the time because, obviously, Psycho is such a ubiquitous film in the cultural consciousness. But, like I said, everybody knows that shower scene. Like, even though I'd never seen the film before, I knew that he was his mother, which I guess sort of ruined it for me because it wasn't a big shocking. I was like, I knew the whole way through. I'm like, and, you know, it's just one of those films where it's, like, it's really hard to avoid spoilers for because it's so embedded in the cultural, you know, consciousness for just, like, you know, that stuff. So I you know, but just the way it was written in, but, like, I could pick up on that stuff and appreciate it where, you know, like, Norman has lines like, oh, you know, she's in herself today, or he's like, you know, I like stuffing things, or, you know, a boy's best friend is his mother. Even if I hadn't known, like, obviously if I hadn't known that beforehand, you think back, oh, I thought it was really smart. But even knowing what I knew, I could still appreciate those, like, the foreshadowing of those lines to where, like, if I hadn't known the twist and I'd gotten to the end, I think I would have been even more like, wow, that was really great foreshadowing in the script. And
absolutely. I think the beginning of that archetype, the overbearing mother, you know, think, you know, The Simpsons, Seymour Skinner. Obviously, his character, I think it's already been mentioned, that his character is based on Norman Bates, you know, slightly. You know, his mother, he always listens to his mother, he's single. The overbearing mother, specifically in horror films, I think started with Psycho.
Yeah, like, this is the thing, like, how many Perkins just played his character so well? Because, like, when you first meet him, like, he seems very normal. You know, like Marion is the one acting weird and strange because she's, like, you know, on the run because she's stolen all this money, and you think, well, he's, you know, he's being normal. And even, you know, when the private investigator meets him, he's very normal and you wouldn't think twice about it. But then, you know, slowly, you know, his weirdness emerges. He's talking to her and he mentions all these strange, you know, things. You know, and this like mask of civility that he has, you know, starts to slip, and I'm like, that's, it's like what a psychopath would do, you know, they appear normal, and eventually the mask wears off and you see them for what they are. So I thought just the way he portrayed that was really good. And even though, like, I knew what happened, like, in the sense, I mean, I didn't know what happened, but I mean, I knew, you know, the big twist of it, he was his mother. Like, I didn't, after she died, and, like, her body was in the car, I didn't know where it was going to go. Even though it didn't shock me at the end when it's like, oh, the mother's dead, I still was, like, guessing the whole way through, you know, because I was like, where's this going to go? Like, how is it going to connect to her dying? And I didn't actually know she died either. Like, I knew she was obviously stabbed with all, you know, you've all seen the shower scene, even if you've seen it parodied, you know, you've seen it in a sense. So I knew she, but I didn't actually know she died. I thought she was just stabbed in the shower. So then when she died, I'm like, oh, this is totally shocking. Like, where is this going to go?
Anything could happen.
Right, exactly.
He could have taxidermied her.
Well, you know? Exactly. Stuck her on the wall, you know. And even like when Arbogast was stabbed, you know, I was like, I was shocked, you know, because you sort of knew it was coming, sort of figured, oh, that'll happen at some point. But then you see him, you know, come out of the room, obviously dressed like his mother, and, you know, and then it just, the tension just goes even higher. I did feel the pacing was, like, a bit slow up until Marion died, but I do think it picked up after that. But I just think that first sort of, like, however long it was, 30, 45 minutes, it was, I did find it sort of slow. But, like, my final point would be, a lot of times with films, you know, a lot of the problems I have is I can't suspend my disbelief because I'm like, this is so stupid, this would never happen, blah, blah, blah. But I will say with Psycho, as ridiculous as it is in some sense, I'm like, I could see it happening. You know, like, he lives in this, you know, like he says, the hotel is, you know, the motel is off a beaten path. You know, it used to be on the main highway and they, like, redirected it, so no one comes there anymore. Except for all intents and purposes, he seems like a nice guy. He presents very normal. It's not until you sort of start to probe him or talk to him for an extended period of time that you sort of realize this guy's pretty fucking weird. You know, you could see that happening. You could see that this guy, you know, does kill his mother and would keep her corpse there. You know, like, stranger things have happened in real life. So I actually bought the premise. Like, I think I expected to come out of it thinking, oh, that was silly. But I'm like, is it likely that it would happen in real life? No, but is it possible? Sure, it's possible. I can buy it happening. Certainly. And even the thing of, you know, he killed all these other people. He killed, you know, the mother, and he killed the, the, you know, her lover, and then, you know, you get to the end in that the detective or, you know, whoever, police guy says, oh, have we got missing, you know, is there a missing persons case? Oh, yeah, there's two, you know, girls. I'm like, yeah, I could buy that, you know, because there's tons of people who, you know, kill lots of people and they get away with it, you know. So I'm like, I actually bought the story, as sort of absurd as it was. I was like, yeah, I can buy it. Like, it could happen.
Hitchcock sells it to you and you buy it, you know. That's the magic of film sometimes. There was the prequel series as well, if you've heard of it, Bates Motel.
Oh, yeah. Yes. Oh,
I've forgotten the actors that are in that.
Yeah, isn't it, I was going to say, like, Freddie Highmore or someone.
Yeah, he was like... in the remake of Charlie and the Chocolate Factory.
Yeah, it is him, yeah. Because I'm the same. Like, I just know him as, like, you know, Charlie from Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, or, like, you know, August Rush, he did, like, Finding Neverland. I'm like, you're that little kid actor. And then he's, like, Norman Bates.
Yeah, now he's a little serial killer that has blackouts.
Like, yeah, I haven't watched that series, but I have heard good things about it.
Yeah, I mean, it is good. I watched maybe 2 seasons of it. I don't know how many seasons there are, because I ended up stopping. I stopped watching it. But, yeah, it's supposed to follow him sort of innocent, and his mother just won't let him do anything, and then falls in love, I think he's a police officer or a sheriff or something. And I think it's filmed in this at the same place, the same house and everything, or unless they've completely recreated it. Yeah, like, it's good, but again, it's one of those, it's a TV series, you know. I mean, you got wow TV series, and you got it's a TV series, you know what I mean? There's different contexts with the way I'm the cadence that I'm explaining it, but yeah, like, it's crazy that they even did it.
Yeah, well, like I said, it's a very influential film. You said it spawned sequels, it spawned TV shows, it spawned imitators ad nauseum, and yes, you think it was released over 60 years ago, and it's still influential today. Which, you know, you could say for a lot of Hitchcock films, that's the truth. So yes, I'm sure George will pick more Hitchcock for us to view in the future. I'm sure he'll pick more
black and white films. Yep.
Black and white films. So you better get used to it, because that's what he likes.
No, that's fine. That's good. That's good.
We look forward to seeing what next week brings.
Absolutely. I'm keen.
Well, I think that wraps up episode 37. Thanks, everyone, for tuning in. If you enjoyed today's episode, we'd love it if you could give us a rating on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, and we'll see you next week.